Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. We are all made of stardust, science tells us. That's a theme that comes up several times in a book by our next guest. Alan Townsend's faith in science helped him face some major losses in his life involving people close to him. He tells the story in the book This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder. It is a book that manages to be both devastating and uplifting. Alan Townsend is a scientist, an ecosystem ecologist, and currently the dean of the College of Forestry and Conservation at the University of Montana. He's written many academic articles and was one of the scientists featured in the Let Science Speak documentary series of several years ago. Alan Townsend, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Nice to be here.
It is really quite a journey you take us on in the book, starting with the prologue. You write of the stardust that is the stuff that makes us up and wax poetic about we're really just temporary collections of it.
Yeah, that's, intentional in there as you see as you go through. But as I write it in there, it's I think I say something about that stupid hippie bumper sticker, right? But that, you know, it's one of those cliches that we're all made of stardust, and it's true. And but as that reality started to converge first with my own field of science, which is to study the elements that make up us and how they move through the world, and then in particular, as that overlaid with, the things that happened in my life, I started to see all that in a different light.
Was thinking about our temporary nature any comfort to you as you faced your daughter's treatable brain cancer and the other brain cancer that would ultimately take your wife from you?
It really was. And I'm not going to lie and say, it just made me feel all better in the moment. It didn't. You know, those were pretty devastating moments. But when I had time and, time after my wife passed to kind of think through it, I did manage to find some comfort in just that connection and the way in which, at least through the lens I think about the world, we really are all connected in that way. And there's a certain sense of immortality even in that, and that helped me deal with it a little bit.
Yeah, there is a real sense of like our stuff is going to go on even if we don't. I mean, the idea that the things that were once in stars are in us now and will become other things when we're done with these elements and atoms. It's kind of thought provoking on many levels.
Yeah, and it's as you mentioned, I'm an ecosystem ecologist, and so I mean, for those who the vast majority who don't know what that even is, it has been my job to study these elements that form all of life and how they move in and out of life. And it's pretty remarkable. I mean, it's important to us as a society, but it's also just cool in the ways in which they move through the world and they really do connect us. And that helped me think about that a lot, not just in the way the world works, but the way humans work as well.
So I think about the particularly painful parts of your life that you describe here, the brain cancer of your daughter, Neva, and the different and fatal brain cancer of your wife, Diana.
Yes.
I think about the pain in your life and how you relate it to a story you tell, or I relate it to a story you tell early in the book about doing research in the Amazon and encountering creatures that could induce great physical pain. And let's take that sidetrack. Who was this other scientist, Justin Schmidt, who cataloged that pain?
Yeah, so Justin Schmidt was, nobody I ever actually met in person, but he was a pretty well-known entomologist. So he studied bugs, right? And he got to a certain level of fame and notoriety because he was both a funny guy and a little nuts in that he was very interested in how a whole bunch of different pain-inflicting animals, what that really meant and why they had those systems and what it did to us. And he was studying the science of all of that, right? The science of venom, the science of, whether it was a snake or a nasty ant or something else that can really ruin your day. And at some point he decided he needed to personally experience all of that to really understand it. So he kind of went through the list of a whole bunch of nasty stuff and got himself stung or bit by these things. And then ranked them all on what became known as the Schmidt Pain Index and wrote some really funny stuff about it. Like he has these descriptions of each one that I think I write in the book. And one of them he talks about being like, chained in the flow of an active volcano and why the hell did I start this list in the first place?
Right, <yeah.
laughs> he was nuts, but funny.
Yeah, why did I start this? He made a choice. And choices, as you point out in the book, make a big difference. I mean, and so when your life turned really grim, you did not choose not to feel, but what did you choose?
Oh boy, that's a big question. What did I choose? I think I'm trying to think about how to thoughtfully answer that one. I mean, one off answer is that when, you know, for anybody who's gone through, you know, sudden hard news like that, sudden hard medical news or something else, at least for us, and I suspect it's true for most people, there's just no question that you're suddenly playing catch up, right? I mean, you're making all kinds of logistical choices, but, you know, the space and room to choose for yourself about how you're going to handle that seems to just be ripped away from you in a hurry. And so that's just the reality of it, right? Between first just learning that you know, Neva had that diagnosis, which was shocking and overturned our lives, and then a year later hearing Diana's, I do feel in that phase there was a whole bunch of just kind of managing and playing catch up. One of the things that really helped me, astonishingly so, that I do write about in there a lot, is just how remarkable Diana was, my late wife, and how she dealt with it all. She just kind of had a remarkable equilibrium in her that wasn't sort of over the top bravery or battle or the rest. She just kind of kept living her life and living a life that was full of a whole bunch of curiosity and full of a whole bunch of kind of balance and how she looked at the world. And that brought a certain kind of ease. It was a choice of its own that allowed many of us around her to settle a little bit too.
Alan Townsend is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder. Let me take a sidetrack on another story of bugs, caterpillars and metamorphosis. How is that gooey process a metaphor for any life, or maybe even more than that, life on the planet?
Yeah, so I mean, as you say, it's kind of early in the book. There's a briefly take the sidetrack to talk about how the process of a caterpillar turning into a butterfly looks nutty, looks almost impossible. The caterpillar quite literally dissolves, or mostly dissolves. It just seems at one point in it to turn into this just liquid soup of things from which it would seem impossible for some subsequent beauty to emerge. And the reality is that there are these cells in that soup, these things called imaginal cells. They form in these little things called imaginal discs. And those encode what comes next. And from that emerges this wholly new, different creature. It's an interesting one historically because, you know, prior to some of the scientific understanding around it, I mean, it was even used as an example that resurrection was possible, that it really was death, and then, you know, there was new resurrection of life and all this kind of thing through it. And for me, it's just one of many examples that really did start to help me going through this and after, and it's kind of one of the bigger messages I'm trying to convey in the book that I think is accessible to anybody, is that the world around us is just the way it works. So it's been my job to study that world and study those ecosystems, but they're so full of examples of those kinds of transformations, of these moments that look utterly dystopian. They're just like, oh my God, like all hell is broken loose here, and this is the end of this particular world, and you couldn't imagine anything good coming on the other side. And not only does it, it's often necessary for it to happen. And, you know, just remarkable beauty can emerge after these moments of destruction in the natural world. And that just helped me kind of think about the path through my own life and the path through grief and being open to that possibility and the reality that, you know, as human beings, that's often true for us too, as long as we keep ourselves open enough to find it.
Yeah, the reference you make in the book along those lines is to volcanoes. I mean, they destroy lots of things around them, but they lead to great beauty, as in your native Hawaii. You make the great case that the apocalypse can lead to something wonderful, which is easy for you to say now. But you, at the time of Diana's diagnosis, could not just be a scientist, could you?
Yeah. So yes and no, right? So from both Neva's and Diana's, that because we were both scientists, she was a biologist as well. You know, they were these moments where, in one sense, science was always personal to us because it was our jobs and we loved it and we did it, and, you know, but it still still was more of a professional and intellectual pursuit. And suddenly it just became very deeply personal because we desperately wanted to use that scientific training and understanding to help find cures, right? To make medical decisions, to do the things that, to find that outcome that we wanted to find. And so I really struggled with that for a while. And that, you know, that's the reality of science in the world, is that it's full of all kinds of incredible answers and all kinds of insight and all kinds of innovation, but it can't solve every problem. And it doesn't always, you know, cure us as much as we try. And ultimately we're all mortal and all those kinds of things. And so that was a new experience of both desperately trying to use the tools of science to find answers, and simultaneously, and this is, again, as you know, is part of what I tried to grapple with afterwards in the book and write this, is the lessons from science for how you let some of that go, right? How you just accept that this is how it is, this is how the world is, and find some peace in that.
Alan Townsend is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a scientist and the author of This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder. I want to ask a little bit about your work, because I get the sense from your descriptions of walking into a forest, any forest, is sort of like some people walking into a church.
Yeah, I mean, it can be for me, and has been for a long time, or just being out in the natural world. I mean, I was lucky to grow up in some really beautiful places between Hawaii and Montana, where I am now, and so that instilled that in me from young. Definitely the places I worked and that are, you know, central in the book there for a long time, being in those tropical jungles, being in the Amazon, being in these areas of Costa Rica was, they're astonishing, and they always brought kind of a certain peace and greater sense of self to me being in there that I know can be true for folks who regularly attend church.
You find some parallels between religion and science, it seems. I mean, not in the same general sense of belief, but up to a point.
I do. And, one of the things I've told others, and it's true, and talk about a little bit in the book itself, is that I didn't grow up with an organized faith tradition or any religion. I didn't go to church. I'm still not that way. And when I was younger, especially kind of getting into a path through science, it did lead me, and I'm not alone in this sometimes, to just having a certain lens on what religion was and wasn't, and sometimes, quite honestly, looking down my nose a little bit at it. And in the sense of like, yeah, that's great, but, you know, if you want the real answers for how the world works or what we need as a society, you have to look at science. And there's a narrowness and arrogance in that hit me later. And they are very different things, but especially going through our family's path, you know, I just started to realize that there's commonality in their best forms. These are both human approaches and constructs that are looking for answers that better our lives. And however you want to define that, both can bring a whole bunch of comfort that often have some real parallel outcomes.
We mentioned that Diana was a scientist too. Was it something of an accident that you guys met?
Yeah, it was. I mean, she was a replacement for somebody who was a collaborator on a project that we were working on in Costa Rica. The guy that was supposed to join us on a field campaign could not, and she got sent instead. And so there was one of those unusual happy moments that just kind of came out of the blue.
Diana was tough. I mean, as you point out in the book, I mean, then some of the stories of her final days are particularly moving. We'll get to those later. But for example, why did she not go to medical school at Tulane?
because during her interview, I think it was the dean at the time, but it may have been somebody in a position of power, asked her if she planned to have children while she was in medical school, which is obviously utterly inappropriate. And Diana being Diana, she on the spot told that person to F off and decided to pursue a different path for her life.
We're talking to Alan Townsend, a scientist, ecosystem ecologist, now the dean of the College of Forestry and Conservation at the University of Montana. He writes something about science, but also about his personal life in a book called This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder. Alan got to watch as first his daughter was diagnosed with brain cancer, which was treatable, and she is alive. And then his wife, Diana, was diagnosed with a different kind of brain cancer, which was not treatable, and she's no longer with us. So the book is a pretty amazing work, but we're exploring the parts of Alan's life and how he puts the science and what happened to him all sort of together. And in fact, Alan, the book pings around a bit in time and place, but brains can be like that, as you point out. Even kind of pathetic, you say. Why pathetic?
This is where I get myself in trouble, right? Is that I am a biologist, and as we've discussed, but my field is ecology and not neuroscience, and so had some background. And but in after Diana passed, and just trying to understand her path through it and think about this more broadly, I did a lot more neuroscience reading, and so now I know just enough to be dangerous. I think what I'm trying to get at that is that, and explore a little in here, is that, I mean, our brains are obviously astonishing, but in particular, we as a species evolved under a certain set of pressures and conditions and needs for most of our existence until very recently. And our brains are often set up so perfectly to handle the kinds of more chronic stresses and interactions that a modern daily life brings. And it's not that they don't do it remarkably well in many ways, but there are some weird offsets, right? It's a cliche, but we get stressed out all the time about all kinds of little stuff, and that doesn't do us any good. In fact, it literally eats away at us in some ways that lessen our health. And that's just a product of, systems within our brains that originally developed to deal with the more acute stresses of a pre-modern life.
Well, and there's a part of the book where you actually relate back to somebody else's book, Hope Yaron, and the story of Moore.
Yep.
We had her on in 2020 to talk about that. It's one of those indications that maybe human brains are not geared to keep up with the kinds of pressures we're putting on each other and the planet.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's right, right? And they are and they aren't, right? I mean, they're astonishing. And I mean, one of the interesting things, too, that I talk about a little bit here is they're astonishingly plastic in the sense of, like, they can change themselves. You can train them themselves. You can do all kinds of remarkable things with them. But a lot of our basal responses and indications are not ideally tuned to, for example, minimizing a lot of those daily stresses or setting aside a lot of the deliberate reactivity that, modern society tries to inject into us, and work together well and, express our creativity and our connection over stress and fear. That's a constant fight for us.
You give us a pretty good map of the brain, in a sense, and also talk about your brain's reaction as you're learning of your daughter Neva's tumor crowding her pituitary gland. Now, what did you and Diana notice in Neva's growth and development that prompted the search for a cause?
Yeah, so that was, it wasn't we knew something wasn't right. It wasn't a very long period of time, but over about 4 months, I'd say, we started to notice that she wasn't growing in ways that she should have been relative to her peers. This is when she was 4 years old, just turned four and a little shorter, and that's fine, but also just kind of gross motor development stuff. She was just really behind her peers, and that was a little unusual. I'm not quite sure what was going on. And then she started to have a lot of headaches, and that's pretty weird for a young kid. So we, went down a step-by-step diagnostic path with her pediatrician first that ultimately led to the recommendation for an MRI. By that time, we, the curse of science, we'd done enough Googling and looking through the primary literature to recognize a range of possibilities, one of which could have been a pituitary tumor of some kind, but nobody thought that was it because what she had is quite rare. And that turned out to be wrong. It turned out to be the explanation for it.
Huh. And she was operated on. It was successful. She is doing well, as you've told me before we got started here. But, boy, the hell. I mean, how old was she? 4 years old at the time?
She was, yeah. So she was four when she was diagnosed. And so, you go from that shocking news to a couple weeks later, an 11-hour brain surgery. And, that uproots your life in a real hurry. And then, in her case, she had to do it twice. And so first surgery was partially successful and great in that she came out fine, but their brain surgery is a delicate business, and it was the right call from her surgeon not to remove all of it in that first surgery, because trying to remove every piece of it just would have been too dangerous for other reasons. And so took what he could, and we had to wait and watch. And then ultimately we knew it would probably start to regrow, and it did. And so she had to have a second surgery at age 7, but happily at that point they were able to get everything, and she's been cancer free since.
Wow, and that's great to hear. Diana's brain cancer, of course, was totally different. This was not the kind that surgery fixes. Was there even an attempt?
There was, yeah, and it's typically part of it. So she had glioblastoma, two of them, in fact, and so they're same tumor that Joe Biden's son passed from, that John McCain passed from. They're nasty ones, and we just don't have a good cure. I mean, there's some remarkable science being around it and some remarkable innovation, and every once in a while there are miracles, but basically, you know, with a few exceptions, nobody makes it through or tends to make it too long. Surgery usually is part of it when they can do it, just because it slows things down. So she did have surgery, but, you know, ultimately we knew that was probably just a temporary solution.
We're talking to Alan Townsend on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder. Oddly enough, though, we've established already that Diana was tough. You could not pull a lot of things past Diana, but as a scientist, she celebrated the limitations of science. Can you explain that?
She really did, and this really came out as we were trying to deal with complicated decisions around NEBA, and then even for her, and in the sense that, you know, science, if you let it, should teach you that you want to keep pushing for answers and you want to keep finding what you can, but it's often the case that you're not going to get a perfect answer. You're just not going to know. And she was pretty good at understanding that lesson as well, even when it was applied to our own family. And it's one of the things that I mentioned in studying the neuroscience. Like, how did she just find so much comfort in that? And for her, I think it was, one, science for her was, I mean, she cared deeply about answers, but she just loved it. She loved the process. She loved the curiosity behind the whole thing. She loved the wonder behind the whole thing. She was totally okay with recognizing that she was pursuing some big and hard questions about things that she'd probably never get the full answer. And in fact, she kind of liked that was the reality of the world. So I think that helped when we were confronting situations where, you know, you had no clear answer on what to do, and you just had to have some faith and judgment and do your best and find comfort with it.
Yeah, well, science certainly did hit its limits in Diana's treatment. It was not successful, ultimately. But it's not just that you lived through the loss, but then you wrote it down a few years later. How much of that was her idea?
It was mostly hers. So the caveat, I mean, the backstory there is, as you're alluding to, she asked me to write this book. And she did that just a couple months before she died, as she was starting to lose some ability to communicate. And, you know, she was also a remarkably generous person, even through her illness. And she, you know, she quite literally said to me that she wanted me to write it in the hopes that our story could help others going through hard things. And her lens into that, I think, was that when I've always loved to write, but mostly that was in science. And when NEBA was diagnosed, I'd started this blog that was largely about just kind of communicating the science I do to a broader audience. We went home that night, and I was obviously so turned upside down from the whole thing. I just sat down and wrote a piece about it, and without thinking much, I just put it up on the blog. There was not much intentionality other than it was really for me to work through it. And had a good number of people end up reading it and respond and share some feelings that had helped them as they were confronting difficult things. So I just started to write more short pieces as our family went through this. And so she'd seen that. It even led to us connecting with a couple families that we helped out some around their own childhood cancer decisions. And that's, I think, what led to her in the end to ask me to write it. I also, she didn't say this, but knowing her, you know, I think she also knew that I did the writing for me to kind of work through hard things, and she probably thought it would be helpful to me on the other side as well, which it was.
Was it, a book is different from a blog, but even so, I mean, once you let yourself go, was it like you ran through it all, or was it a longer, more considered process than that?
It was a very long process, partly because I didn't really know what the hell I was doing.
But it doesn't show.
You know, I sat down and finished a first draft of it just a little over a year after she passed. And that was really just get it out. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I worked with some people and got some feedback and went through and wrote a whole second draft of it. And that took another year or two. to really get through that and do that as I, you know, had a day job the whole time. And then I thought, oh, okay, now I have to find an agent and figure out how to publish this thing. And I was really fortunate to get to work with someone who's wonderful and brilliant, but that, you know, that's when I learned the reality. And so had to go back and work on a book proposal and rethink the whole thing. And she really helped me think about some changes to the book that more reflect what it is today. So that was another big, long chapter and basically meant that I rewrote the book for a third time. So it was years.
Yeah, well, it must have been somewhere in the early stages of that process that you appeared in the documentary series we talked about, Let Science Speak. It must have been really hard back then to talk about what you'd been through. Why was it so important to do so?
It was. I mean, that was a hard thing to do, and you know, for two reasons. I mean, one, I believed in the mission of that documentary, which was just trying to help restore or improve some trust in science just by reminding people that, you know, scientists are just people too with real feelings and real lives and all the rest. And that matters, unfortunately, in this polarized society to have that reminder. And then partly again, it was just kind of Diana's request of Lens that she was the one who, you know, who clearly expressed the desire for me to share our story. And that was a chance to do so.
So Let Science Speak started before the COVID pandemic, and it seems like science is taking another whomping through that whole process. I mean, what do you kind of make of the world you find on the backside of COVID?
Yeah, I mean, it has, right? And it's the kind of painful irony to me is that so much of where we find ourselves, I would argue anyway, in this deeply divided, polarized society is in part a product of some of the tools of science and the understanding of science being used for the wrong purposes, right? And so creating, you know, using psychological understanding, using an understanding of, you know, social systems and the rest to create media approaches, social media platforms, other kinds of approaches to political debates or other debates that deliberately amp up our reactivity and our fear. And that's deliberate, and that's based upon scientific understanding, puts us into these boxes where we can't have the more nuanced conversations and we erode trust in each other. And science itself has become a victim of that for reasons that have nothing to do with its inherent realities. And that just, I mean, it's obvious, right? But it worries me because it just means that we as a society end up making poorer decisions that harm people.
Is it that much trickier in your line of work at the College of Forestry? I mean, forestry is always an argued over sort of branch of science. Not that there are any that aren't argued over, but it's a big one, particularly in the West here.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I see it all the time, right? And my longer path is that, you know, I'm not even so much of a classic forester by training. I mean, some of it, but I've done a lot of climate science work. And so obviously I've seen that for my whole career as all kinds of debates and politically charged things around that. And that continues to be the case where, you know, you just see these deeply entrenched camps that are often not operating on just the basic facts. And that's sad to me. And, you know, that was in the end, even in this book, it was it's a story of our life and the rest, but there's a deliberate attempt in there to try to show science through a different light and remind people that, I mean, at one point, I think I say something to the effect in there that, you know, if we try to demand perfection from things in our lives, we're going to have a lousy path. Like, nothing's perfect. And that includes science. And that doesn't mean that something has to be perfect to lend it our trust. And we can allow for some fallibility. We can allow for some uncertainty. And in fact, we should in our lives. And we're instead often pushed on paths that become way too polarized around that, and so I try to address some of that.
Well, the book will give your heart a workout and your brain as well. It's called This Ordinary Stardust, A Scientist's Path from Grief to Wonder by Alan Townsend. Alan, thank you so much for sharing this on the Jefferson Exchange.
You bet. It was nice to be here.
And that's it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Check us out online at jeffexchange.org. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.